So, what's so democratic about democracy? The word, from the Greek demos, or demos people most at a time, and krasi, an alternative spelling for the American word crazy, is tossed about lightly. Well, now we're going to have Mind's Eye Radio take a crack at it in our new show, Vox Pop, or Speaking Democratically. That's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach for everybody. The New Colossus by Emma Lazarus. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sun-washed sunset gate shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. That was Emma Lazarus writing The New Colossus. So, what's so democratic about democracy? The word, from the Greek demos, or demos people most at a time, and krasi, an alternative spelling for the American word crazy, is tossed about lightly. So what are some aspects of cultures that are truly democratic? Weather, so far, well, if you ignore cloud seeding and global warming. And how about health? After all, anybody can afford to be healthy, right? Well, actually, you can sort of buy better health, and it's not spread out equally among rich and poor. Well, how about distribution of intelligence? Now we're talking. Okay, how about this? We'll let Mind's Eye Radio have a crack at it in today's show, Vox Pop, or Speaking Democratically. We're a nation of immigrants, we say, and it becomes truer by the day. But can long-established residents really appreciate what their forefathers and foremothers put up with to enter into the wonderful social compact that we call democracy? Greg Landretti helps us recall.
I wonder what my grandparents thought about when they emigrated from Italy during the first part of the 20th century. I can only imagine the anxiety as they faced so many unknowns. I don't think they had any philosophical discussions about democracy, but I'm sure they talked about how much money they would make, where they would live, and what they would eat. Maybe they didn't talk about democracy in so many words, but they must have envisioned the concept as hopeful, because they were willing to risk everything during the dangerous voyage across the frigid North Atlantic. They certainly were not alone. Immigrants came over in hundreds of ships, with names like the Provence, the Madonna, and the Lusitania, like metal shavings being attracted to the powerful magnet of democracy. Scores were lost to the weather, hundreds succumbed to disease, and others were torpedoed by the prowling U-boats of the German fleet. They came from all over Europe, hoping to live under a simple, open, and tolerant form of government. Fathers journeyed first to establish themselves in the logging camps and company houses. After earning passage, they beckoned boatloads of mothers who crossed the sea with children clutching their legs, frightened and pale with seasickness. Together, they built America under a watchful eye of democracy, while sweating through their shirts in the factories of Chicago and breathing the red ore dust in the deep iron mines of Michigan. Many, like my grandfather, died young, and the company gave his widow $50 for burial and a 12-pound ham. Yet, more families arrived to replace the worn-out labor and to allow democracy to produce unions, political parties, railroads, electricity, abundant food, and the promised land of prosperity. I find the courage of those young people, drawn to nothing more than a democratic ideal, remarkable. What is even more remarkable is the continuing desire of people from all cultures wanting to participate in the American democracy for a better life, for freedom, and for the American dream. This is Greg Landretti for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you. Have a good day.
I don't really agree with the American dream. I just want to basically keep myself happy. And if that means I end up working some stupid factory job for the rest of my life, that's fine.
So what is it that's going to make you happy?
I don't know. Keep myself in food in a house and a little bit of spending money here and there. I've come to believe that if I start making a lot of money, I'm going to want more and then want a little more.
The time that I spend awake seems to be getting better and better and better. The weather's really nice, that helps.
Are you striving to get somewhere with this?
No, I gotta pedal like hell almost every day to stay even, but I like staying even.
I just think if you make yourself happy, you're doing fine here. What does it make me happy? Having people around me that love me. I like to do art, so if I could make a career out of that, that'd be nice. You know, that would make me happy. I don't know if I'd make a lot of money, but that's not really what matters, you know.
The American dream is a reality because you look around you and you look at America herself and you see many, many things and many, many ways you can become prosperous. But unfortunately, there are two classes, maybe three classes of people. And it all depends on what class you fit in as to how you fit into that American dream. I would have to hate to say, unfortunately, being black and poor, you fit in the lower class. It's almost impossible to make the American dream unless you are a great basketball, football player. That's the concept that's been played out with minorities. So that's most minorities' aspiration, is to become some superstar. Without that, I would say the majority of black people would just linger in a non-reality and try to find that American dream with some other means. So it's the American dream is here, but it's really a nightmare in reality to most poor people.
The American dream, basically, it takes a lot of work to get it for me. And, you know, I kind of want the dream, like, given to me, and I don't really want to do the legwork to get there. It's a lot.
Well, actually, I think the American dream is run much out of control after World War II, with the idea of competitive consumerism and everybody seemingly thinking that enjoyment comes from owning rather than just being.
Well, I'm not sure that the American dream really exists for everybody.
Did it ever?
It worked for me. I was when I was young, it was in the 50s, and everything was pretty much programmed. You know, you went into service, you came out of the service, you went to college, you got married, you bought a house, you got a job, you have kids, and everything worked out. Now my kids are in that age, and it's not working out so well for them. Unless something is done to equalize the economic opportunities and the things that everybody needs, I don't see that there's going to be much change, and I fear for this country because of it.
Shifting into America is hard. What we need to know here, how we should feel, what we need to do, is not taught us by our aunties or grandmas. America is not from a mother's heart, an elder uncle's wisdom, or a prophet's teachings. So much we lose, we are no longer when we understand, when we become America.
Madison writer Renaud Catalani.
Independence Day. I didn't wake and smell the coffee. Haven't for a while. Not since she left coffee cooker under arm. So I do Starbucks, Southwest 2nd Street. It's Saturday, it's real early, it's time for citizenship class. Parking lots abuzz at our Asian family center, maroon Camrys, white Tonkin Toyotas, sleepy grandkids dropping off ancient ladies under heavy winter coats, inside thick wool scarves. Good morning, teacher! Good morning, teacher! They bow, they smile, they chatter like anxious macaque when there's leopard in the air. I lift my face, straighten my spine, embarrassed by elderly folks' respectfulness, ashamed of my mood. Mr. Tack unlocks the upstairs door. The rush is like McKinley Elementary at 8:45, but slow, slow-mo like $6 million man pumping across Mojave. They try and try 22 minutes later. Everyone's up those stairs, out their winter stuff, into their usual seats. Mr. High gives a Saturday morning citizenship pep talk. Same as last week, same as we tell our kids. You can do it, you must. Polite's real important. Say, good morning, sir. Remain standing till Mr. Examiner invites you to sit. Always answer, no, sir. Yes, sir. Polite's big when you got no power. These elders got no political punch. Food stamps and Medicare's going away unless they pass the citizenship test. Okay, okay, I say, and they all look my way. 10 Viet grandmas, 2 Chinese ones, 1 smiling Lao grandpa. We're level 1, the A team. Today we'll work on. Today we walk on, they echo. They do. It's no use trying to stop them. It's how they learn. Back before TV, before the American War, before the French War, before Pearl Harbor. Who? I write it real big. Okay, okay, let's do who. I pace in front of them. Okay, okay, let's do who, they parrot. Then they go to work. They think long at their yellow pads. Who's president, I say. Who? Who's president? Everyone drops their eyes while I stalk like you and me in algebra. Didn't do the homework. Please, oh, please don't call on me. They write, they try. We don't want them to write. We need them to listen, hear key words. Most can't read anyway. School wasn't there, wasn't necessary for our omas back then. I stop in front of Madam Q. Who's president, madam? Who? President. She knew last week. She did. She thinks hard. She says, George. Yes, yahalah, that's it. I dash back to our whiteboard, write George, add Bush, underline it, circle it, poke it with my miracle marker, George Bush, George Bush. And they chant, George Bush, George Bush. And we're having such a good time chanting George Bush. When is harder? I know it. They know it. They squint killer concentration. Okay, okay. When's Independence Day? When? Independence Day. Oh, I wish I could say Freedom Day. Everyone knows that word, freedom. Freedom translates easy, no political science necessary. But I'm no Mr. Examiner won't use Freedom Day. He'll insist on Independence Day. And even if I go down there, say, with tiny Grandma Maher, hold her trembly hand, give her courage, I just make it worse. Like the time I went with sweet Mrs. Neary and glancing up, Mr. Examiner read, if so required by your commander-in-chief, would you be willing to bear arms in defense of the nation? Bear? Oma Neary's lips moved. Arms? She knew bear, like little sun bears back home. She knew bear, sure, like naked, like nude, like we won't say, like decent ladies don't say, no, not with menfolk around, never. She knew arms, like what you dip into cool rice paddy water. like where you hold your baby tight, like how you cradled your soldier boy right after he understands he's dying. She's a ma, she knows these things, she knows. And I was getting mad, you barracuda bureaucrat I was. But then I saw all this in a breath or two in Grandma's face. So I said instead, through his interruptions, I said, oh, my dear, please listen. If America has a big, big fight, if Mr. Bush asks you, Oma, go fight for America, will you, Mrs. Neary? Will you fight for America? Oh, yeah, to bony fists. Yeah, I fight. When? I write it real big. When is Independence Day? When? I walk in front of grand old Madam Kim. She'll remember. She likes our when game. She knows. She thinks a little slow, but she knows. It's in her eyes. You just have to wait a minute. Madam Kim always wins our when were you born game. They say their birthday I write each on our blackboard. Green star, never a red one. Next to our big three winners, 1925, 1922, and dear Madam Kim's 1918. 85 back homes, not like 85 here. No Oregon water, no wintergreen toilet mints, no toilets, no one-a-days with calcium, no measles shots, no maternity leave, 12 babies, 4 wars. So far, far from home, I should award her my citizenship certificate. I lean lower, ask softer, when, madam, when's Independence Day? When? Her eyes rise. 4 July, she smiled. This is Ronald Latangsayan Catalani.
Madison writer Judith Sokerman.
The scene is Chicago, nearly a century ago. Fiery orators stand on soapboxes, wooden platforms, as hundreds, sometimes thousands, gather to listen, cheer, heckle, or challenge the speakers. Children stand among the crowd, spellbound, watching as if a magician were waving his wand. Officially known as Washington Square, the locals call it affectionately by its nickname, Bug House Square, named for the characters found in the square. In the Newberry Research Library facing Bug House Square, seminar papers by Professors Mulroy and Nichols in 1996 quote Roger A. Bruns in The Damnedest Radical to reveal the Chicago legend behind Bug House Square. In the city's infancy, a well was dug on a cow path on the north side prairies. As people gathered at the well for water, they often stayed to debate the great issues of the day. When Erasmus Bushness and his friends donated the little tract of land to the city in 1842, they required that it forever be a public square. In the early 1900s, Bug House Square was an active place. Progressive Party speakers talked about making the country better. Suffragettes argued for women's rights, the Equal Rights Amendment, and giving women the right to vote. Others argued every worker should work only an 8-hour day. Ideally, this was free speech in its truest form, but in the 1900s and 1910s, speakers were sometimes arrested by the police. Chicago was not alone. From 1900 to 1917, 25 to 30 American cities like Fresno, California, Missoula, Montana, and Kansas City had free speech battles between city officials and industrial workers of the world, IWW, called Wobblies, which this year are celebrating their 100th anniversary. The Wobblies were fighting for their right to promote their union and its goals. If they lost their right to speak in squares like Bug House Square and in street meetings, it would mean the death of the union in many communities, They had no other way to reach workers who traveled from place to find work, hobos traveling in railroad boxcars. Some were even arrested for reciting the Declaration of Independence. In Bughouse Square, speakers argued to stay out of World War I. Some were communists or anarchists. City officials worried they would start a revolution. The police chased them from Bughouse Square and arrested some of them. Clarence Darrow, a famous lawyer, drew up a petition with 15,000 others to restore free speech. Darrow got an injunction restraining the police. Free speech was protected in Bughouse Square. Over the years, many ideas were defended and challenged in Bughouse Square. Ben Rittman, a hobo as a poor boy, who later became a doctor, was king of the hobos. He created Chicago's Hobo College near Bughouse Square. In 1926, 164 hobos got a diploma for serious learning from university professors who taught them subjects like philosophy and art. Practical lectures on laws to protect themselves from being arrested were included. Rittman, a Bughouse regular, argued for birth control when people were arrested for teaching about it. Christians from nearby Moody Bible Institute enjoyed being challenged by the square's atheists and hecklers. Others spoke of socialism, free love, capitalism, communism, and more. Whenever the weather was good, Bughouse Square was busy in the evenings and Sundays from 10 a.m. to midnight. Heckling, listening for mistakes speakers made, and challenging them became a fine art in Bughouse Square. When it was cold, free speech continued inside at the Dill Pickle Club a block away, where all ideas were welcome. Over the door, a sign said, "Step high, stoop low, leave your dignity outside." Artists with no money could pay a bill with a painting. Diverse people lived near Bughouse Square, including the wealthy on Chicago's Gold Coast, famous writers like Carl Sandburg, unknown artists and writers, and hobos and unemployed workers. In the 1950s and 1960s, fewer and fewer people came to Bughouse Square. Chicago had other squares, but Bughouse Square was where free speech flourished. As a tribute to the Bughouse Squares of yesterday, I invite our listeners to recreate safe places in their own communities for free speech, whether they be in schools, neighborhood houses, or on newly created community radio stations, or by bringing new vitality to free access TV stations or today's websites and blogs. In closing, I hear my dad's voice from long ago echo in my ears. Get off your soapbox, Judy. This is Judith Zuckerman, a Chicago native, from Mind's Eye Radio. And by the way, if you are in Chicago on the last weekend of July, the Newberry Library recreates the Soapbox Debates, hecklers and all.
If spouting is democratic, Paul Thompson has been a recipient of lots of democracy in the following.
Okay, everyone, this is going to be a diatribe. The term diatribe comes from the Latin. Die, meaning I'm dying to get this off my chest, and tribe, meaning you may want to vote me off the island when I'm through. Diatribes occur in all societies, but in authoritarian societies, they tend to be restricted to the maximum leader, who can foam on for hours. Democratic societies make up for this by having shorter diatribes, but more of them. My particular diatribe concerns what I call borrowed or spurious authority. I can best define it by giving an example. A fellow from California named David Griffin came through our community the other day to give a talk in which he claimed the Bush administration had foreknowledge of the 9/11 attacks and may have even collaborated in them. His authority for this statement? He's a theologian, a retired one at that. In terms of authority, I'd rather listen to my appliance repairman, who at least knows how to fix a washer dryer and has served 3 terms on her city council, so he does know something about government. Now, if my appliance repairman had rented a hall and lectured on 9/11, nobody would have come to listen. But this theologian, a noted theologian, as the newspaper put it, attracted an audience of 450 people who gave him a standing ovation at the end. Another example. A local church has scheduled a speaker on evolution. The speaker is advertised as Dr. Paul A. Nelson, a fellow of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. Notice those magic words. Doctor, fellow, center, institute. Sound awfully authoritative, don't they? Well, Paul Nelson's doctorate is legitimate enough, from the University of Chicago, but it was in philosophy, not biology. He teaches at an evangelical college, and the center of which he is a fellow is devoted to attacking Darwinism. Now, he well may be a bright fellow, and he may have studied the field of evolution closely, but without the trappings of authority, who would listen to him? We Americans are suckers for borrowed authority. Anybody with a few letters after his name feels justified in speaking up on all subjects, no matter how remote from his or her field of expertise, and we sit there listening with our mouths open and drool running down one corner. Reminds me of those ads when I was young, showing a guy in a white coat smoking a cigarette with a caption, 9 out of 10 doctors approve Philip Morris. Then there are virgin birth authorities who, with no particular expertise in anything, build themselves a reputation by publicity. The most outstanding example I can think of off the top of my head is Faith Popcorn, born Faith Plotkin, who originally wanted a show business career but wound up writing ads, and then vaulted into the ranks of gurus by calling herself a futurist and issuing predictions of all sorts, some of which undoubtedly hit the mark, like firing a shotgun at the side of a barn. Today, she's a Fortune 500 consultant, lecturer, workshop teacher, newsletter publisher, etc., etc., etc. A Fortune magazine called her the Nostradamus of marketing, which is one of the most ambiguous compliments I've ever heard. Next up before the firing squad, entertainers who make pronouncements on public issues, using what may be a well-deserved reputation for their craft to sound off on any and everything. The Dixie Chicks are only one of a long line stretching back to Jane Fonda and beyond. Who cares what a 3-chord rock artist thinks about the world? Does anybody really take these pronouncements seriously? Yeah, I'm afraid so. Or modern political campaigns wouldn't be loaded with string pluckers and nasal whiners, and Congress folks wouldn't be listening in awe to movie stars pontificating on everything from stem cell research to the plight of baby seals. We writers are as bad as any. Shelley called poets the unacknowledged legislators of the world, but today we want to be acknowledged, to strut ourselves on the public stage, often at the expense of what we really have to offer through our craft, our sense of language, our faithfulness to the rich ambiguities of life. Somehow we feel compelled to voice our opinions on all matters of things, not simply as citizens, which is what we ought to be doing, but as writers, in italics, as if we somehow were illuminated from within to serve as beacons to mankind. but all too often when we enter the public realm, our rhetoric coarsens and we spout the most tired cliches of politics: fascist, racist, leftist, elitist, progressive, fundamentalist, capitalist, and the like. I suspect we get this bad habit from the Europeans, the French in particular, and their idea of l'homme engagé. Think Jean-Paul Sartre, who followed Stalin blindly to the end. Let's get over it, guys. But my appliance repairman may have the last laugh on all of us who take on borrowed or fake authority. I hear he set up a website and is now calling himself a blogger. He's commenting on judicial appointments, what's happening in the Arab street, and whether you're committing a mortal sin if you have the doctor yank your feeding tube. I expect soon those in high places will be following him on a daily basis, nay, hourly. Isn't democracy wonderful? This is Paul Thompson reminding you that 9 out of 10 doctors approve Mind's Eye Radio.
So there must be a few more democratic shibboleths to be had. Perhaps you'd like to stick around for the second half of the show, Vox Pop, or Speaking Democratically, and hear what the citizens have to say. Lewis Rawl pairs his vision of the voice of the people with some musings on the relationship between the state and a state religion. What did that one amendment really have to say about this pairing?
Freedom of religion is one of the cornerstones of democracy. However, separation of church and state is something different. Many democracies have an established state church, supported at least partially by taxes, sometimes voluntary. At one time, there was a disestablishment movement in Britain, but anti-disestablishmentarianism carried the day. Why do we have an anti-establishment clause in our Constitution? The answer is fairly simple. A majority of delegates to the Constitutional Convention subscribe to the Anglican or Church of England, now called Episcopal here. The next largest group were Congregationalists, and there was a smattering of other faiths. Many of the delegates thought establishment of the Anglican Church would be a matter of course, but there was a snag. We revere the Declaration of Independence for its high-minded sentiments, but it consists mostly of complaints about George III, King of England. Since His Majesty was also head of the Anglican Church, the rejected political leader was unacceptable as spiritual sovereign of the new country. As a majority of delegates were uncomfortable with religions other than their own, it was decided that no religion was to be established. It should be mentioned that the Declaration of Independence is a theistic document, referring, for example, to a creator. Its architect, Thomas Jefferson, proclaimed himself to be Unitarian. Flushed with the later purchase of Louisiana, he predicted that Unitarianism would sweep westward from New England and become the de facto religion of the United States. This, shall we say, has yet to happen. However, the largest Unitarian congregation is now in Madison, Wisconsin, west of Boston, but still east of the Mississippi River. Over the years, The barrier between church and state has proved permeable to varying degrees. Churches have always had the legal power to marry persons, a civil contract, but the local government provided licenses. In the 19th century, Congress placed the words, "In God We Trust," on currency and coins. This could be interpreted as an expression of religious faith, or a cynical observation that human beings are untrustworthy. In either case, it is an example of establishment of theism, as some people do not believe in God. Also in that era, the teaching of Protestant theology in the public schools forced Catholics to found their own school system. In the 20th century, overt religious observances in public schools were banned, but setbacks also occurred. In 1954, Congress was quaking with fear of the Soviet Union and communism. They decided the best way to defend our country was to insert the awkward phrase, "under God," into the Pledge of Allegiance, instead of working toward liberty and justice for all. This bit of establishment introduced a hiccup into a previously smooth-reading political statement of loyalty and unity. Strangely enough, this religious statement, "And in God We Trust," have been upheld by the judiciary, which is now being criticized as being against people of faith. At the beginning of the 21st century, we are in a phase of erosion of the barrier between church and state. This movement has been called conservative, but it is actually reactionary. It is set as one of its goals the elimination of the hard-won rights of women to plan their families, for example, not to speak of denying homosexuals the status of human beings. The so-called faith-based initiatives are another manifestation of this intrusive move to establishment. In addition, some states now require teaching of the religious concepts of creationism or intelligent design, which are based only on faith, as alternatives to based-on-fact evolution. You may be comfortable with these trends, but beware. If the government can impose your beliefs on others, it can impose the beliefs of others on you. Think about it. This is Lewis Rawl from Mind's Eye Radio telling the government to back off from my religion and everyone else's.
And when do we best exercise our democracy? No, not when we're shopping. And not when we're choosing our mates, though that's a good answer. It's when we're practicing being enfranchised. That's right, in the voting booth, or so we hope, as Kathy Miner notes in the following essay.
I miss voting booths. My city has gone to using computer-read ballots, which you fill out with special markers in little, not very private study carrels, then feed into a scanner when you're through. A successful scan is signaled by a wimpy little toodaloo sound. I loved the old-fashioned curtained booths. You would walk in and flip the big handle to close the drape behind you and assure that no one could see how you marked your ballot. Choices made, you'd flip the handle the other way to record your votes and reopen the booth. That was accomplished with a satisfying, utterly dramatic whoomp that really underlined the gravity and responsibility of your democratic participation. When my sons were small, I would take them with me to the polling place and into the booth. It was a big deal when they were strong enough, each of them in turn, to pull the handle and make sure my votes got counted. Years later, it was an even bigger deal the first time they were old enough to vote themselves. Maybe it's the change in methods, or maybe I've been getting disillusioned for any one of a number of reasons, but I've been sloughing off just a bit on voting in recent years. I didn't skip any presidential elections, but sometimes, if the races were only local and it was a complicated day, I'd make one excuse or another and not make it over to the school gym to cast my ballot. That changed this spring, though. In March, my husband and I took an unforgettable bus trip through Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, visiting landmark sites of the American Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s. We stood on the corner in Montgomery where, when the city bus stopped and a white man boarded, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. We visited the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, where in September 1963 a bomb exploded, killing four young girls and eerily blasting only the face of Christ out of a stained glass window. We toured the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, in the former Lorraine Hotel, standing under the balcony where Martin Luther King died, looking across to the window from which James Earl Ray fired his fatal shot. At a slavery and Civil War museum, we saw artifacts of slavery and the Middle Passage juxtaposed with African-inspired art and felt the severing of a culture. And perhaps most movingly of all, We walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, the scene of Bloody Sunday. 40 years earlier, marchers intending to walk all the way to Montgomery had been tear-gassed and brutally clubbed by Alabama police as they came over that bridge. They were stopped that day, but soon prevailed in the courts and in the hearts of Americans, and a couple of weeks later completed their march. Their ranks swelled to tens of thousands. What were these people marching to their state's capital for? For what did they put their lives and livelihoods at risk? What was the cause for which Viola Liuzzo died and so many were traumatized? The right to vote. Other demonstrations in other places highlighted other aspects of racial injustice in America, but in Selma, the focus was on voting rights, simply having the right to choose the people who will hold governmental power over you. Less than a week after we got back from our tour, there was a local primary election. No big deal. In many of the races, the candidates were unopposed. I was still swamped with post-vacation and catch-up things, and it was tempting not to bother, not to walk over and use that anticlimactic modern device that says toodaloo as it registers my vote. But I found I couldn't stay at home. Cynical though I may have become about governmental corruption and the power of a single voter, I now know I have a larger faith to keep. For all of those ordinary people who became extraordinarily courageous when it really counted, the ones who died and the ones who lived and the ones we'll never know about, for the sake of all of them, I promise I will not fail to cast my ballot. Hoping to hear a whoomp one of these days, this is Kathy Miner for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Esther Cameron.
This is an extract from the book which the puppet masters of the post-democratic soundbite culture do not want you to read, The Consciousness of Earth, an epic poem on the ecological crisis in all its dimensions, including political. It aspires to be a training manual for a new and wiser counterculture. The Consciousness of Earth proposes, as a supplement to democracy, a form of organization through which those of us who still can think might acquire some leverage over the system. The hexagon, referred to in the passage I will read, is a structure, purely imaginary at this point, that serves as meeting place for this organization. Here is what the Consciousness of Earth has to say about democracy. Democracy. That is the name by which we know that leave of absence from compulsion which still is granted to us. Its premises are that each one of whatsoever rank shall have one voice to choose those who shall rule, and that the authorities shall recognize as greater than themselves the laws that shield the citizen from the high hand of power. The law and universal suffrage keep watch on the hierarchic tendency, so that the dignity of all is guarded, and a place cleared for free exchange of thought. That is democracy. It is a form effective while, to the extent to which we truly live within it, have not moved elsewhere, and left the empty scaffold standing. And if that has occurred, then it must be, seeing that we have placed our faith in form, that in our freedom's diagram some corner was left unfinished, or an entire side, so that we have walked out into compulsion unawares and find ourselves benighted, far from the house in which we thought to dwell. It is perhaps that in their haste to bar the door against the power to coerce, the founders did not wholly realize that there's an obligation to instruct, which is not won by contest at the polls, nor purchased with the chair of any office, but laid by knowledge, insight, conscience on the one who sees. Whoever has felt that hand upon the shoulder knows that truth is not decided by majority approval, so that to step into the election ring to prove it, but betrays it at the start. And therefore, where the people place all faith in the electoral process, those who see have little choice but to look tongue-tied on, while multifarious temptations tunnel their way into the house and clear it out. Here the poem harks back to the discussion of coevolution in the earlier chapters. Not all at once, perhaps, but gradually, as weeds and vermin gradually discover the fields we clear, the houses that we build, and change themselves, the better to infest them. Did those who take the polls for their foundation learn how to play to ignorance, appeal to prejudice, hold up the seeming easy answer to the questions of the crowd that less and less knows what it asks? Until the leaders sell themselves to those whose hands are on the dials that synchronize the music, the simulacra, for the mind-stunned mass. They speak like actors what they did not write, and thereby win the power to decide on what they little understand, as pressure by block and contribution may determine. Starting, perhaps, from the hope of doing good, they soon find strings being tied around their wrists. To twist the lures for hypnotized opinion that strikes at any bait, so shape and color be fashioned to its reflexed expectation, and to map out, through the mind afield, the sea dotted with Scyllas and Charybdises, the one course that would get us through unscathed. These are two different arts. The second must begin far from the market and the poles, and maybe far, for now, from learning places that seem but markets of the intellect, where technical contrivance overtowers humanity, and profitable theory thrives upon differences that advance the individual career, but seldom tend toward the building of a common world. But now let us suppose the hexagon founded, if only in the mind as yet, that house of wisdom, Sabbath space to which the seekers of the peace of earth, however schooled and however occupied, repair with tithes of thought, to linger in the company of friends, listening long to song and story, then once again depart toward various fields that now divide the earth. Dwelling in Possibility, I'm Esther Cameron of the Hexagon and Mind's Eye Radio.
Lynn Patrick Smith covers the full range of representative societal ills in Brought to Your Attention.
Accepted lies and misdemeanors, conservative scare tactic theater. All the inspectors who can't pass their own inspections, the scandalized preacher who is not so modest, the convicted judge he thought was honest. I only say this to bring to your attention, when you join the institution, you are given keys. You better not lose them, because they do not hand out spares, just free passes to the electric chair, where they'll shock you until your vision is blurred. And when you're finally blind, they'll claim you are cured. I am bringing to your attention the tattered lining of the silver promise, the cheek cheerleader thinking she's a goddess because she knows all the latest fashions, the jobless wonder what's the attraction in knowing how you should dress, someone stolen your last hope chest. Except lies and misdemeanors, conservative scare tactic theater. All the inspectors who can't pass their own inspections, the scandalized preacher who is not so modest, the convicted judge he thought was honest. I only say this to bring to your attention the endless parade of fake crusaders is joined by political masqueraders who say if you wish to avoid disaster, you must look to them for all the answers. They complain the loudest that kids aren't learning, but they're first in line at the big book burning. I am bringing to your attention. Artist censors that think salvation is granted for lack of imagination. They sterilize the poet's vision, set guidelines for moral living. If you challenge boundaries, it's resistance. They'll investigate you while keeping a safety distance. Accepted lies and misdemeanors, conservative scare tactic theater. All the inspectors who can't pass their own inspections, the scandalized preacher who is not so modest, the convicted judge he thought was honest. I only say this to bring to your attention. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Democracy works pretty well, but what if we coupled it with the ideal economic system? Writer John Morgan lays it out for us.
The United States, the world's oldest modern democracy, is now engaged in what it calls a war on terrorism. It seems totally oblivious to the fact that its militarist, imperialistic foreign policy created terrorism in the first place. It seems oblivious to the fact that it is impossible to fight terrorism because that only perpetuates it. The only way to end terrorism is to renounce the policies that created it. Another fact the U.S. seems oblivious to is that as it continues its blundering ways by trying to convert tyrannies into democracies in the worst possible way, democracy has sprung up spontaneously in Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim country. It was not imposed on them at gunpoint. Perhaps our government could learn a lesson there, if they are paying any attention. Ultimately, it is economic corruption that corrupts and destroys democracies. With that in mind, I shall make a modest proposal here. If the U.S. wants to preserve its democracy and end terrorism, the best thing it can do is disappear. What, you will ask? How can a nation of 295 million people disappear? Very simply, by an act of magic. Corporations do it all the time. They are so fond of mergers and acquisitions that maybe the U.S. could take a cue from them. We could disappear by merging with Canada and Mexico into one country. This proposal has so many merits that I can't see how any nitpicking pessimist could find fault with it. Think of the benefits. The wage levels of the three former countries would adjust so that neither one would be too poor or too rich. Drug prices would drop to the level of Canada's so that we could all afford them. And we would all become trilingual, making us much more sophisticated. There's an old joke. What do you call someone who speaks one language? American. That would no longer be true. Instead of saying, the robins have returned, the first litter of pigs has arrived on the farm, the rain falls soft on the field, we could say, los peches colorados se están retornados, la première partie de cochon est arrivée à la ferme, the rain falls soft on the field. But the best part of this merger would be that this new nation would have the opportunity to reset history and start over again. It would be able to renounce militarism and imperialism. It could proclaim itself a humanitarian nation whose foreign policy was dedicated to helping other countries fight poverty and disease, but only if they asked. As such, what I shall provisionally call the Republic of North America would no longer need an army. Its military would be converted into a civilian army. This army would still have 10 divisions, as ours does now, but they would be quite different divisions. There would be one division of doctors and nurses, one of engineers, one of farmers, electricians, artists, musicians, actors, dancers, and one division of jugglers. We would only make friendly invasions of any country that requested our aid. Another advantage of this merger is that it would give us the opportunity to wean ourselves off of capitalism and replace it with a real economic system. Capitalism is not an economic system. It is an economic process that has never been systematized. Not only that, it is a process without a rational or intellectual foundation, because it is a process that was spawned by the culture of war. All attempts to justify it intellectually, from Adam Smith to Alan Greenspan, have been grand sophistries. The fact is that millennia of war finally spawned capitalism, whose only purpose is to perpetuate the culture of war. War and capitalism perpetuate each other in a feedback loop, which is obvious now to any impartial observer. But the alternative, which I shall provisionally call cornucopism, is based on the concept that everyone should be paid for being born. It's the only sensible thing to do. How would that work, you ask? Well, under cornucopism, the tax system and the wage system would both be different. In the first place, there would be no taxes, because taxes are not necessary. Since government creates money, all it has to do is keep enough of that money to fund its basic functions. Then it won't have to impose taxes on society. The wage system would be quite simple. Everyone would have the same income, but it would increase as they got older. This would combine equality with inequality. Everyone born would have an account opened for them by the government. This account would contain all the money they would make in their lifetime, but it would be dispensed to them in increasing amounts on debit cards. Children would get an allowance every year equal to their age times $100. At age 20, their adult income would begin at $20,000 a year. That would increase by $1,000 a year until by age 60, they would be making $60,000 a year, where it would level off for their lifetime. The incentive to work is self-explanatory. People would realize their money would only be worth as much as the goods and services they produced. The spirit of cooperation would prevail over the spirit of competition. With this system, there would be no need for Social Security, health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid. There would be no possibility of loans, borrowing, interest, banks, bribery, blackmail, or theft. There would not be an excess of money available to fight wars. Money would be restored to its original function, which is to facilitate the exchange of goods and services. Its corrupting influence on economics and politics would be eliminated. Jay Gould's boast that he could hire half the working class to kill the other half would no longer be possible. These are all things that the Republic of North America could accomplish. With such an example, and with voluntary humanitarian help available, the oppressed countries of the world would likely throw off their shackles and decide to create a new civilization. To those who say these ideas for democracy are unrealistic and impractical, I answer, look, my friend, at the status quo. Not only is it unrealistic and impractical, it is dangerous and deranged. As Herman Melville said, how long does it take to get to the end of the road to nowhere? Maybe we wouldn't even recognize sanity if we saw it. To quote Melville once more, the past is the textbook of tyrants. The future is the Bible of the free. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
Let's see now. What else is democratic? Not health care, not really education, maybe weather, for the time being. It rains, after all, on the just and unjust alike. Oh, that gives me an idea. There's death. Now, surely that cometh to all persons. But wait, I just read the other day that scientists may soon be able to slow and reverse aging, and perhaps... Oh, no, wait a minute. The article noted that the cure for dying will be fabulously expensive. Oh, drat. Oh, well, at least there's the weather. That's our show. Thanks for listening to Vox Pop, or Speaking Democratically, on Mind's Eye Radio. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski, the Duchess of Democracy. Today's citizens were Esther Cameron, Greg Lendretti, Kathy Miner, John Morgan, Rano Catalani, Lewis Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Paul Thompson, Judith Zuckerman. For more information about us and upcoming shows, go to www.mindseyeaudio.com. You can also hear this and past shows at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four. I'm your host, Greg Williard, saying, raise your voxes, ye populi. Best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.